Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Drinking, a Love Story, read by the author. And now, Caroline Knapp. It happened this way. I fell in love, and then, because the love was ruining everything I cared about, I had to fall out. This didn't happen easily or simply, but if I had to pinpoint it, I'd say the relationship started to fall apart the night I nearly killed my oldest friend's two daughters. I'd been visiting my friend Jennifer over Thanksgiving weekend a few years ago, and we'd all gone out for a walk after dinner, she and her husband and the two daughters and me. The kids were 5 and 9 years old, beautiful little blue-eyed girls with freckles and wide grins, and I'd been playing rambunctious friend of mom's. I chased them around and hoisted them up into the air, and then, in a blur of supremely bad judgment, I dreamed up the double marsupial hold. I put the older girl, Elizabeth, on my back, piggyback, and then I picked up the younger one, Julia, and held her facing me, so that her arms were around my neck and her legs around my waist. I was sandwiched between them, holding 130 pounds of kid. Then I started running across the street, shouting like a sportscaster, "It's the double marsupial hold! They've accomplished the double marsupial hold!" And then I lost my balance. I flew forward and came crashing down, and I still believe it's a miracle that Julia's tiny 5-year-old skull wasn't the first thing to hit the pavement. Somehow I kept her in my arms and allowed my right leg to take the fall, and I remember hitting the ground and feeling something like a minor explosion in my knee. The kids were okay, but I ended up in the emergency room with a gash on my knee so deep the nurses could see my kneecap. 3 months later, I quit drinking, beginning the long, slow process of disentangling myself from a deeply passionate, profoundly complex, 20-year relationship with alcohol. I drank. I drank Fumé Blanc at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and I drank double shots of Johnny Walker Black on the rocks at a dingy Chinese restaurant across the street from my office, and I drank at home. For a long time, I drank expensive red wine, and I learned to appreciate the subtle differences between a silky Merlot and a tart Cabernet Sauvignon and a soft, earthy Beaucastel from the south of France. But I never really cared about those nuances because, honestly, they were beside the point. Toward the end, I kept 2 bottles of cognac in my house. The bottle for show, which I kept on the counter, and the real bottle, which I kept in the back of a cupboard beside an old toaster. The level of liquid in the show bottle was fairly consistent, decreasing by an inch or so, perhaps less, each week. The liquid in the real bottle disappeared quickly, sometimes within days. I was living alone at the time when I did this, but I did it anyway, and it didn't occur to me not to. It was always important to maintain appearances. I drank when I was happy, and I drank when I was anxious, and I drank when I was bored, and I drank when I was depressed, which was often. I started to raid my parents' liquor cabinet the year my father was dying. He'd be in the back of their house in Cambridge, lying in the hospital bed in their bedroom, and I'd steal into the front hall bathroom and pull out a bottle of old granddad that I'd hidden behind the toilet. My mother found that bottle, empty, that April, the day of my father's funeral. I'd thrown most of the others away, but I must have forgotten that one. And she discovered it stashed behind the toilet as she was cleaning the bathroom for guests. I was sitting at the dining room table, and as she walked through the room, the bottle in her hand, she glared at me, a look of profound disappointment. So I lied. "That was before," I said, referring to a promise I'd made her 6 months before my father died. "2 drinks a day," I'd said. "No more than that. I promise I'll cut down." I'd made that promise on a Sunday the previous July, in the midst of a pounding hangover. I'd been visiting my parents at their summer house on Martha's Vineyard, and I'd gotten so drunk the night before I almost passed out on the sofa, sitting there right next to my mother. I'd done the drinking in secret, of course, stealing off to my bedroom every 30 minutes or so to take a slug off a bottle of scotch I'd stashed in my bag. The next day, my mother asked me to take a walk with her on the beach, an unusual move for my mother, who requested a private audience only when she had something very serious to say. I remember a feeling of dread and contrition. I was hoping. We made our way down the dirt path that led from our house to Menepsha Pond, a blue arc of water at the bottom of the hill, and then we walked for a while in silence. Finally, she said, "I need to talk to you. I'm very worried about your drinking." I said, "I know." I walked beside her, keeping my eyes on my feet in the sand, afraid that if I looked up, I'd bump too abruptly into a truth I didn't really want to see. I added softly, "I am too." I could tell from her tone that she wasn't angry, just worried, and I had to admit to her, I was too, sort of. We walked some more. She said, "This is very serious. It's more serious than smoking." My mother was the sort of person who chose her words with the utmost care, and I understood that a wealth of meanings ran beneath that simple phrase, more serious than smoking. Smoking caused cancer, a disease that was killing my father, that had killed her just a few years later. She understood that drinking was more dangerous, and she understood why. Smoking could ruin my body, drinking could ruin my mind and my future. It could eat its way through my life in exactly the same way a physical cancer eats its way through bones and blood and tissue, destroying everything. "It really is serious," she said. I kept my head lowered. "I know. And I meant it, at least just then." There are moments as an active alcoholic where you do know, where in a flash of clarity you grasp that alcohol is the central problem, a kind of liquid glue that gums up all the internal gears and keeps you stuck. For an instant that day, I did know. I could see it. I was 33, and I was drinking way too much, and I was miserable, and there had to be a connection. My mother was such a gentle woman. She said, "What can I do to help you? I'll do anything I can," and that's when I made the promise. I looked out across the pond, not wanting to look her in the eyes. "I don't know," I said. "I know I have to deal with it." I told her I'd look into Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "In the meantime, I'll cut down. 2 drinks a day, no more than that, I promise." I'd meant it. That afternoon, I took the ferry from Martha's Vineyard to Woods Hole, en route back to Boston where I lived, and I remember sitting there on the boat, vaguely nauseated, my head still aching from the night before. I wanted a beer, just 1 beer to help ease the headache, and I debated with myself about that for several long minutes. Shouldn't I prove to myself that I could go a day, just 1 simple day, without a drink? Shouldn't I? The 90-minute ride to Boston loomed ahead. I had the beer. And then, when I got back to my apartment, I had a little wine with dinner. Just a little. 2 glasses, but they were small ones, so I considered them half glasses and counted them as 1. From that point on, though, I was always very careful around my mother. Careful not to drink more than 2 glasses of anything in front of her. Careful never to call her when I was drunk. But I didn't keep the promise. And that's how it works. Active alcoholics try, and active alcoholics fail. We make the promises, and we really do try to stick with them, and we keep ignoring the fact that we can't do it, keep rationalizing the 3rd drink or the 4th or 5th. Just today, bad day, I deserve a reward, I'll deal with it tomorrow. A few weeks after the walk with my mother, I read a book that mentioned a test people could take in order to determine whether or not they're alcoholics. The test involved setting limits. 3 drinks a day for 6 months, no more, no less, and no variation no matter what the circumstances. Someone dies, you still don't have more than 3. You get fired from your job, just 3. Weddings, funerals, celebrations, disasters, it doesn't matter. I can't even remember how many times I took that test, dozens of times. I also can't remember consciously deciding to stray from the rule or to cheat, to have the 4th glass of wine or to pour the 3 glasses in such enormous goblets I might as well have had 6. I just couldn't do it. Alcohol had become too important. By the end, it was the single most important relationship in my life. A love story. Yes, this is a love story. It's about passion, sensual pleasure, deep pulls, lust, fears, yearning hungers. It's about needs so strong they're crippling. I loved the way drink made me feel, and I loved its special power of deflection, its ability to shift my focus away from my own awareness of self and onto something else, something less painful than my own feelings. I loved the sounds of drink, the slide of a cork as it eased out of a wine bottle, the distinct glug-glug of booze pouring into a glass, the clatter of ice cubes in a tumbler. I loved the rituals, the camaraderie of drinking with others, the warming, melting feelings of ease and courage it gave me. Our introduction was not dramatic. It wasn't love at first sight. I don't even remember my first taste of alcohol. The relationship developed gradually over many years, time punctuated by separations and reunions. Anyone who's ever shifted from general affection and enthusiasm for a lover to outright obsession knows what I mean. The relationship is just there, occupying a small corner of your heart. And then you wake up one morning and some indefinable tide has turned forever and you can't go back. You need it. It's a central part of who you are. I used to drink with a woman named Elaine, a next-door neighbor of mine. I was in my 20s when we met, and she was in her late 40s, divorced and involved with a married man whom she could not give up. Elaine drank a lot, more than I did. She drank especially hard when the relationship with the married man got rocky, which was often. She drank beer and vodka, and she'd call me up on bad nights and ask me to come over. The beer made her overweight, and the vodka made her sloppy. And she'd sit on her sofa with a bottle and cry, her face stained with tears and mascara. I used to sit there and think, whoa. I'd sympathize and listen and say all the things girlfriends are supposed to say. But inside I'd be shaking my head, knowing she was a wreck and knowing on some level that the booze made her that way. That the liquor fueled her obsession for the married man, fueled her tears, fueled her hopelessness and inability to change. But some small part of me, it got larger over the years, was always secretly relieved to see Elaine that way. A messy drunk's an ugly thing, particularly when the messy drunk is a woman, and I could compare myself to her and feel superiority and relief. I wasn't that bad. No way I was that bad. And I wasn't that bad. I had lots of rules. I never drank in the morning, and I never drank at work, and except for an occasional mimosa or Bloody Mary at a weekend brunch, except for a glass of white wine, maybe two, with lunch on days when I didn't have much to do in the afternoon, except for an occasional zip across the street from work to the Chinese restaurant with a colleague, I always abided by them. For a long time, I didn't even need rules. The drink was there, always just there, the way food's in the refrigerator and ice is in the freezer. In high school, the beer just appeared at parties, lugged over in cases by boys in denim jackets and Levi's corduroys. In my parents' house, the scotch and the gin sat in the liquor cabinet to the left of the fireplace in the living room, and it just emerged every evening at cocktail hour. I never saw it run out, and I never saw it replenished either. It was just there. In college, of course, it was there all the time. In small, squat refrigerators in dorm rooms, in kegs at parties, in chilled draft glasses on tavern tabletops. And by the time I graduated, by the time I was free to buy alcohol and consume it where and when I wanted, drinking seemed as natural as breathing, an ordinary part of social convention, a simple prop. Still, I look in the mirror sometimes and think, what happened? I have the curriculum vitae of a model citizen or a gifted child, not a common drunk. Hometown, Cambridge, Massachusetts, backyard of Harvard University. Education, Brown University, class of 81, magna cum laude. Parents, esteemed psychoanalyst, dad, and artist, mom, both devoted and insightful and keenly intelligent. In other words, nice person from a good upper-middle-class family. I look and I think, what happened? Of course, there is no simple answer, no single moment, no physiological event that pushes a heavy drinker across a concrete line into alcoholism. It's a slow, gradual, insidious, elusive becoming. When you love somebody or something, it's amazing how willing you are to overlook the flaws. Around the time I hit 30, I started to notice that tiny blood vessels had burst all along my nose and cheeks. I started to dry heave in the morning, driving to work in my car. A tremor in my hands developed, sometimes persisting all day. I did my best to ignore all this. I struggled to ignore it, the way a woman hears coldness in a lover's voice and struggles, mightily and knowingly, to misread it. I hobbled into the newspaper where I worked the Monday after Thanksgiving weekend, my knee swathed in a large white bandage. Marcia, the managing editor, saw me first. She said, "What happened to you?" I just rolled my eyes. "Ugh, really stupid," I said, and told her about racing around with the kids. I didn't mention that I was drunk, and she wouldn't have thought to ask. The phrase is high-functioning alcoholic. Smooth and ordered on the outside, roiling and chaotic and desperately secretive underneath, but not noticeably so, never noticeably so. I remember sitting down in my cubicle that morning and thinking, I wonder if she knows. I wonder if anyone can tell by looking at me that something is... I used to wonder that a lot that last year or two of drinking. Something is different about me, I'd think, sitting in an editorial meeting and looking around at everyone else, at their clear eyes and well-rested expressions. Can anybody see it? The fact is, nobody would have known from looking. An outsider walking past my cubicle that morning would have seen a petite woman of 34 with long light brown hair pulled back in a barrette, neat and orderly looking. Closer inspection would have suggested a perfectionistic, polished exterior, a careful attention to detail. A young woman with well-manicured nails and black leggings and Italian shoes. A daily list of things to do sitting on the desk, written in perfect print, several items already neatly ticked off. A workspace so compulsively tidy that one of my staff writers used to say you could fly a plane over my desk and it would look like a map of the Midwest, everything at perfect right angles. Colleagues saw me as smart and introspective, a little reserved maybe, and a paragon of efficiency at work, organized, professional, productive. I ran and edited the lifestyle section of the Boston Phoenix, a large alternative weekly newspaper, and I wrote a weekly column, one of the paper's most popular features, and I never missed a deadline, not once, not even when my parents were dying. When I finally went into rehab, I told everyone at work I was going off to a spa, 2 weeks of rest and relaxation and Swedish massage, and no one had any reason not to believe me. I hid it that well. Most high-functioning alcoholics do. Most are in very good company, too, and lots of it. Functioning alcoholics are everywhere, plugging away at jobs and raising families and standing alongside you in the grocery store. We're often professionals, doctors, lawyers, teachers and politicians, artists and therapists and stockbrokers and architects. And part of what keeps us going, part of what allows us to ignore the fact that we're drunk every night and hungover every morning, is the fact that we're so very different from the popular definition of a real drunk. Say alcoholic out loud, and chances are you still get the classic image of the falling down booze hound, an older person, usually male, staggering down the street and clutching a brown paper bag, a pathetic image, hopeless and depraved. Or a ludicrous image, a man made funny and stupid by drink. Think of Dick Martin slurring his words on Laugh-In, or Otis, the happy drunk on the Andy Griffith Show. In fact, the low-bottom skid row bum is the exception, representing only 3 to 5% of the alcoholic population. The vast majority of us are in far earlier stages of the disease. We're early and mid-stage alcoholics, and we function remarkably well in most aspects of our lives for many, many years. I wrote a book during my last, most active year of alcoholism. I wrote several award-winning columns. I spent my days in a bustle of focused, highly concentrated activity, editing stories, working with designers, meeting with writers and editors. And only a very particular sort of person, probably another alcoholic, could have peered into that cubicle and realized that, in fact, I was clicking away at my computer with a pounding hangover, or sitting there at the end of the day, my body screaming for a drink. Or, more to the point, that my life was actually in shambles. By the time I hit bottom, I'd lost both my parents, my father to a brain tumor and my mother to metastatic breast cancer. I was involved with two men, unable to extricate myself from an enormously destructive relationship with an old boyfriend, Julian, and unable to fully involve myself in a more positive relationship with a new boyfriend, Michael. I was living with Michael, still seeing Julian, lying to both men about the other. I was drinking every night, drinking to get drunk, to obliterate. Perception versus reality, outside versus inside. I never missed a day of work because of drinking, never called in sick, never called it quits and went home early because of a hangover, but inside I was falling apart. The discrepancy was huge. On the outside, remarkably, I created an impression of searing honesty. Regular readers of my column had a sense of me as someone who was brutally direct about life struggles. I wrote long, vivid columns about dealing with my parents' deaths, and I wrote eloquently about the long struggle with anorexia I'd gone through in my 20s. And I channeled boatloads of baggage into humor, into bemused and ironic columns about the young single life, about the perils of living alone, my obsessions with bad men, and confusion over what it meant to be a grown-up. My alter ego, the frequent subject of my column, was a tortured and hapless young woman in her 30s named Alice Kay, who lay in bed at the start of each story literally writhing with anxiety, obsessing about men chronically stuck in a rut. People at work were forever coming up to me and saying things like, "I can't believe how self-revealing you are in your writing," and, How does it feel to spill your guts like that every week? It was always clear to friends and colleagues that the line was very thin, that this character's angst was tied very closely to my own. What wasn't clear to colleagues, to me, was how closely linked alcohol was to all that angst. I think I knew on some level that the drinking and the depression were connected, but I also believed that the undercurrents of despair were somehow central to my work. The drink was an occupational hazard, part of the writer's territory. I identified with legions of drinking writers. Carson McCullers, Dylan Thomas, Dorothy Parker, and Thomas Wolfe. Eugene O'Neill, William Faulkner, F. Scott Fitzgerald. Drinking seemed like part of the turf to me, and there was a hard-edged glamour to writers like that that I found deeply attractive. These were dark and tortured souls, artists, people who lived life on a deeper plane than the rest of us, and drinking seemed like a natural outgrowth of their lives and work, both a product and an antidote to creative angst. Plus, with rare exceptions, I never expressed the full extent of my own depression. I made jokes out of it, described Alice Kay staring at the ceiling in despair, poked fun at her obsessive, overly introspective, fearful nature. It's not so much that people like me hide the truth about our drinking from others, which most of us do, and quite effectively. It's that we hide from others, and often from ourselves, the truth about what's really churning beneath the surface. Beneath my own witty professional facade were oceans of fear, whole rivers of self-doubt. I once heard alcoholism described in an AA meeting with eminent simplicity as fear of life, and that seemed to sum up the condition quite nicely. I, for example, had spent half my professional life as a reporter who lived in secretive aspects of the job, of picking up the phone and calling up strangers to ask questions. Inside, I harbored a sense of being essentially inferior and unprotected and scared. Feelings of fraudulence are familiar to scores of people in and out of the working world, but they're epidemic among alcoholics. You hide behind the professional persona all day, then you leave the office and hide behind the drink. Sometimes, in small flashes, I'd be aware of this. One night after work, on my way to a bar to meet a friend for drinks, a sentence popped into my head. I thought, this is the real me, this person driving in the car. I was anxious. My teeth were clenched, partly from spending a long day hunched over the computer, and partly from the physical sensation of wanting a drink badly, and I was aware of an undercurrent of fear deep in my gut. I think I understood in that instant that I'd created two versions of myself, the working version, who sat at the desk and pounded away at the keyboard, and the restaurant version, who sat at a table and pounded away at white wine. In between, for 5 or 10 minutes at a stretch, the real version would emerge. The fearful version, tense and dishonest and uncertain. But I rarely allowed that version to emerge. I anesthetized it. Plus, I was a good actress. Even if you'd seen me drinking my fifth glass of wine in a bar, the only real difference you would have noted was a slight crack in the reserve, a general loosening up. My closest friends used to say that they could see it in me, my drunkenness. They could see my eyelids grow heavy, and they'd notice a slight retreat, a sense that I'd shut down on some key level. But even if they saw me stagger a bit, or heard me start talking in a voice just a shade louder than normal, most people wouldn't have looked at me and said, drunk. Mostly I got loaded quietly, politely. I also cultivated an eminently healthy persona. I exercised madly. I sat at my desk and ate healthy, low-fat foods for lunch. I had friends and admiring colleagues, a classy little apartment downtown, a casual chic wardrobe, a good shrink. So there you go, no problem. Most of the time, that's how I saw it, too. Alcoholism, after all, is a progressive illness. It sneaks up on you so subtly, so insidiously, that you honestly don't know you're falling into its grip until long after the fact. If you'd charted my drinking on a graph, you would have seen it creep up gradually over a long period of years, and you would have seen a host of social factors supporting its rise. Conveniently enough, my 20s coincided with the 1980s, the decade of excess. If the intake and frequency of my drinking rose, it did so culturally as well. I had plenty of company. I moved to Boston in the mid-80s when I was 25, right around the time fancy restaurants with elaborate wine lists began cropping up all over the city. Everyone drank, or so it seemed. and it seemed utterly normal to pass a whole evening in a restaurant or a bar, ordering a third or fourth or fifth bottle of Merlot for the table. Let's go get a drink. Want to meet for a drink? Let's talk about it over drinks. Those were standard phrases in my circle. The line on my graph probably took a sharp rise around my 30th birthday, right around the time it dipped everywhere else. The early 90s, when everyone quit smoking and turned abstemious. The culture swung in a new direction, and I didn't swing with it, and I remember being conscious of that, aware that all of a sudden it was getting chic to stand around at a party and drink Perrier. Perrier? I'd stand there clutching my wine glass, trying to scope out the two or three other people in the room who might be sneaking a cigarette in a corner, and regard this new restraint with a cynical eye. What a stupid trend. What fun is this? But alcoholics are masters of denial, and I managed to keep whatever worries I harbored about my own drinking nicely compartmentalized. So I drink a little too much. It's not really a problem. I said that to myself often, and I meant it. Real alcoholics drank themselves straight out of jobs. They got loaded at lunch and never came back to the office. They were so hungover they couldn't get to work in the first place. They stashed gin in their desks and received repeated warnings about their failing job performance, and they were finally fired. I was not like that, not in the least. I also had a long list of reasons to drink. No one would have begrudged me that. Two major losses in the space of 2 years, a stressful job, deadlines and responsibilities, a messy romantic life, ambivalent and confused. So I drink a little too much. It's situational. I deserve it. I said that to myself, too, with increasing conviction. Stress, depression, an exceptionally bad day or week or month, too much going on, need a little relief, deserve it. That's classic logic among functioning alcoholics. Over time, the drink itself becomes the reward, the great compensation for our ability to keep it all together during the day, and to keep it all together so well. I always liked drinking best after a really hard, solid day at the desk, a day of blood and sweat on the pages. I'd earned it. Times like that, the tension and anxiety I'd feel at the end of the day, the feeling that every one of my cells was crying out for a glass of wine, seemed justifiable and easily explained, a direct result of the daily expenditure of energy. And so the drink seemed justifiable, too. You're cranking away at work and getting promotions and making money and never missing a deadline. No alcoholics here. It's not possible. And yet the truth gnaws at you. One day I tore a sweater and I could see little burst blood vessels all over my chest, red marks that looked like the beginnings of a rash. My twin sister Becca, a doctor, would see those periodically and tell me she thought they were alcohol-related, and I always thought, nonsense. They're from too much sun, back when I was younger. In any event, I looked like hell, and somewhere inside I understood that if I kept this up, kept drinking and working and flailing around like this, I'd die, slowly but literally kill myself. In moments like that, I'd be painfully aware that I was living badly, just plain living wrong. But I refused to completely that awareness, so the feeling just festered inside like a tumor, gradually eating away at my sense of dignity. You know and you don't know. You know and you won't know. And as long as the outsides of your life remain intact, your job and your professional persona, it's very hard to accept that the insides, the pieces of you that have to do with integrity and self-esteem, are slowly rotting away. That was such a typical day. I splashed some water on my face, put on some lipstick and some blush, and went back out to the newsroom. Hey! Across the street meant the Aku Aku Lounge, which was my favorite bar at the end. The Aku was actually a Chinese restaurant, but the right half of the space was occupied by a bar, and everyone from work drank there. Some people drank beer, but the real drinkers, which they served in glasses as big as goblets. A hefty two shots for $2.25, one of the best bargains in town. Some professions seem to invite a lot of drinking, at least in the public mind. Along with the angst-ridden artist or writer, there's the hard-drinking cop or detective who were nearly locked in Farillo on Hill Street Blues, or the protagonists in mystery novels by James Lee Burke and Lawrence Block. And, of course, there are writers. The drinking I did with my colleagues at the Aku had a Lou Grant feel, a group of us trooping in after a long day in the office, gathering at a table, carping about our jobs and smoking cigarettes, letting the tension of the day ease out of our bones. The atmosphere was easy and collegial, and you could order 6 drinks in a row there without raising an eyebrow. They loved us at the Aku, the waiters and the bartenders, because we'd sit there for hours and we always left big tips. Seeing me in the Aku, no one would have known this was a place I merely warmed up. Most of the time I'd only stay there for a drink or two, and then off I'd go. "Gotta run," I'd say, or "I'm out of here." Then I'd grab my bag and my coat, scoot off into the night, off to my busy life, or so it seemed. At the end, I'd become so good at compartmentalizing my drinking that no one had a clear sense of my true intake, including me half the time. A drink or two at the Aku with work friends, then dinner at a restaurant with someone else, 3 or 4 glasses of wine with a meal, maybe a glass of brandy afterward. Then home, where the bottle of cognac lurked beneath the counter, and a bottle of white wine always stood in the refrigerator, cold and dewy and waiting. I can't say for sure when the drinking shifted from normal to necessary. Maybe the year my father got sick, maybe before that. But at some point, I began to notice how edgy I'd start to get every afternoon around 4 or 5 o'clock, and a small part of me began to observe the way I responded. I'd get up from my desk and wander around the office until I found someone who looked about ready to wrap up for the day. "Any interest in a quick drink at the Aku? How about a quick drink?" It was always a quick drink, as if I had things to do, places to rush off to afterward. I was conscious of this, conscious of the feeling of need behind the words. But I managed to ignore this for a long time. I suppose part of me meant it. Just a quick drink, no big deal. The need, and its intensity, was a secret I kept from everybody, myself included. Alcohol travels through families like water over a landscape, sometimes in torrents, sometimes in trickles, always shaping the ground it covers in inexorable ways. In some families, alcohol washes across whole generations, a liquid plague. My friend Abby comes from so many generations of alcoholics she can't count them. Her mother is an alcoholic, and so are 5 of her mother's 6 brothers and sisters. Every one of those siblings married an alcoholic except for Abby's mother. Almost every one of Abby's 28 first cousins is an alcoholic as well. Needless to say, Abby is an alcoholic herself. In the last years of my drinking, I developed a routine of meeting another friend, Eliza, for dinner once or twice a month at a restaurant called Davio's. Eliza's mother is an alcoholic, so sometimes we talk about what it was like for her to grow up in an alcoholic household, how crazy and unpredictable it had been. Eliza's house sounded like a place of chaos and storm, where people lost their tempers and staggered up the stairs, slamming doors behind them. Craziness, dark secrets, alcoholic furies. That's how you become an alcoholic, right? It's encoded in your DNA, embedded in your history, the product of some wild familial aberration. There was always an undercurrent of moral failing in the stories I heard about alcoholics. They were unstable, unwell, irresponsible. And if they were parents, they tore through the lives of their children like tornadoes, drinking and divorcing, screaming and raging. Alcoholics from households like that made sense. When Eliza told me that her brother was an alcoholic too, I nodded. Of course he was. Who wouldn't be with a family like that? Active alcoholics love hearing about the worst cases. We cling to stories about them. Those are the true alcoholics, the unstable and the lunatic, the bum in the subway drinking from the bottle. And they're always a good 10 or 20 steps farther down the line than we are. When you're drinking, the dividing line between you and real trouble always manages to fall just past where you stand. I met Abby toward the end of my first year of sobriety. She showed up at an AA meeting on her 3rd day without a drink, a small woman of 38, rather fragile in appearance, and she looked as shell-shocked as a Vietnam vet, blank and vacant and exhausted. We became friendly early on and started hanging out together a couple of times a week at a little cafe in Cambridge called the 1369 Coffee House. She'd sit there and drop little bombshells about her alcoholic family on the square little tabletop. This one was schizophrenic. That one committed suicide. I rarely knew what to say when Abby told me these stories, so I'd just sit there and look at her intently and murmur things. Oh, God, or ugh. Part of this was the sheer horror of the details. But part of it was something else, too. I could always feel some part of me using Abby's story to call my own alcoholism into question, to compare, to look back and say, me? No way. She came from the kind of household you'd expect an alcoholic to come from, and my own family was so different from that, so much more stable and quiet in its confrontations with pain. We joked about this one day. You're the nice, quiet alcoholic, Abby said, the good intellectual alcoholic. She was right, of course. The nice, quiet alcoholic. I smiled. You never would have known, I said, and then I told her about the very first time I got drunk in secret. I was 16, a senior in high school, and I'd realized over the course of a phone call that the boy I'd been dating was losing interest in me. I forget the phone call, but I remember the feeling, the sense I'd done something wrong. I didn't kiss well, was that it? I wasn't pretty enough. I was in my bedroom on the second floor of our house, and I stole downstairs and snuck a bottle of wine out of an open case in my parents' kitchen. Then I took a corkscrew from the kitchen drawer and went upstairs and drank the whole thing, straight from the bottle. I hid the empty bottle in my closet. This was not the first time I'd ever gotten smashed. I don't remember the details, but I know I was getting drunk at least periodically by the time I was 14. Nor was this an alcoholic frenzy, a matter of physical craving the way it would be later. The drinking felt more like an experiment, an act based on some vague hypothesis I'd begun to form about the connection between liquor and sadness, how one corrected the other. Drink as remedy, I told Abby, a little equation I picked up at home. My father drank. He was a tall, distinguished man of bracing intelligence and insight, and I grew up scared of him, not because he was mean or violent, but because he was anxious and sad himself, and because he had a kind of intensity that made you feel he could see right through you. I was his favorite, and I grew up suspecting that his partiality had to do with some core kinship between the two of us, something he sensed early on. I guess I sensed it, too. As far back as I can recall, I had the feeling that my father was equipped with a mysterious power, a kind of X-ray vision, as though he could turn his psychic laser on me and see a shared darkness, a seed of sadness he wanted to watch over as I grew. Your mother and I made an agreement. He announced this to me one day the year he was dying. It was so much work taking care of twins that we decided she'd take care of Becca and I'd take care of you. We sort of divided you up. I reported this to my mother several months after he died, and she was so mad she practically spit. That is bullshit, she said. We did nothing of the kind. She dismissed it as one of his fantasies, of which, it appeared, there were many. But most fantasies can be bound with a thread of truth. Whether he wished it were true or deluded himself into believing it, the agreement was real to him. My father had always seen me as his child, separate from the others, aligned with him at the core. Both of us had always understood that, without acknowledging it openly, and the understanding had entangled us in ways that would shape me all my life. We never talked much, at least not in the easy, familial ways I imagined other fathers talk to their daughters. But when we did, he always wanted to know something, always wanted something I couldn't give him. When I was 13, my best friend was a girl named Nina, who lived about 20 minutes west of Boston by car, and my father would sometimes drive me out to her house on a Saturday and come back to pick me up the next day. We'd be alone in the car for 20 minutes at a stretch, and this terrified me. How are you? He'd ask. I'd stare out the window and say, fine, trying for a casual tone. A moment would pass and he'd try again. How are you feeling? Then he'd shift his eyes from the road and look at me. My father was a big man, 6 feet tall and 165 pounds, with a high, distinguished forehead and a grave, thoughtful expression. When he questioned me like that, I could see a glint of yearning in his eyes. Not a physical yearning, but a deeply emotional one, edged with discomfort, as though he understood that his efforts to reach me were failing, that I couldn't answer him fully and wouldn't if I could. I'd look at him, then quickly look away. I felt small and exposed in his presence, as though my body were transparent and fragile as air, as though I might evaporate at any moment or blow away. I'd say, I'm feeling okay, and a leaden silence would follow. The older I got, the more powerful my father seemed, probably because I figured out over time that his influence extended well beyond me. He was revered in his profession, adored by students at the Boston University Medical School, where he taught for 49 years, universally respected by colleagues, considered a national leader in psychosomatic research. At his funeral, colleague after esteemed colleague stood up and talked about him. What a fascinating mind he had, how accessible and generous he was with his time, what a rich, enthusiastic presence he'd been. None of the accolades surprised me. I'd always known my father was a brilliant man, but I suppose his intellect fed the sense of hunger I felt around him as a teenager, my feeling that he had this secret store of wisdom that I could only tap into periodically through subtle glances of understanding or flashes of humor. Humor was the one connection we had that felt simple and unambiguous. Despite his weighty presence, my father had a droll, witty side, all charm and charisma, and I loved that version of him. He had one of the all-time great smiles, too. When you said something he found amusing, his whole face would twist into a grin, all teeth and crinkled eyes, as if you'd just slayed him with humor. He could make you feel really special that way, singularly special, as though you were a bright light in his life, and he had some key to that light, a way of accessing the things about you that were real and true. In a sense, even his dark questioning could make you feel that way. There was genuine interest behind it, as though he really wanted to get in there and know you, guide you, share something central. But he was such an odd combination of articulate and awkward, so complex and pensive and remote. Mostly he left me sad, this present, unreachable man. But alcohol changed that. It lightened things, diluted some of the distance and confusion and reserve. I learned that early on, just from watching him. My father had a particular fondness for martinis. He'd come home late after seeing patients, 7 o'clock, 7:30, and he'd take a bath, change out of his jacket and tie, then go into the living room and make up a pitcher. My mother set up the cocktail tray every night, small bowl of raw carrots, small bowl of unsalted peanuts, a tiny glass dish with his twists of lemon, and they'd sit together on the sofa and he'd drink the first one. He never got ugly, not even once. He never even seemed to get drunk until later in his life, when he'd sometimes fall asleep on the couch after dinner. But you could tell, watching him sip those martinis year after year after year, that there was something central about the ritual, something deeply soothing and needful about it. I liked that ritual long before I started to drink myself. Without realizing it, I learned to look forward to it. My parents were normally so quiet. They'd sit on the sofa, my mother knitting and my father staring out the window. And a tension would hang over the room like a fog, a preoccupied silence that always made me feel wary, as though something bad were about to happen. My mother would say something about her day, how she'd ordered some new curtains, say, or taken the dog to the vet. And even though my father didn't ignore her in any obvious way, you'd get the sense that he wasn't listening, yet his thoughts were about 6 blocks down the street. 5 minutes would pass like that, or 10. Then he'd drink his martini, perhaps pour the second one. He'd begin to loosen up, and within a few minutes it would feel as though all the molecules in the room had risen up and then rearranged themselves, settling down into a more comfortable pattern. The martini seemed to take some coarse stiffness out of him, and watching him drink, I'd feel like I'd been holding my breath for a long time, and finally I could let it out. My father introduced me to martinis and Spanish sherry and single malt scotch. The summer after my senior year in high school, he took me to dinner at a Greek restaurant in downtown Boston. It was the first time we'd ever gone out to dinner alone, and he ordered a martini for himself and wine for me. I sat on my hands. I remember feeling that particularly acute brand of teenage awkwardness, unable to think of a word to say. But then the wine came, one glass and then a second glass. And somewhere during that second drink, a switch was flipped. The wine gave me a melting feeling, a warm, light sensation in my head, and I felt like safety itself had arrived in that glass, poured out from the bottle and allowed to spill out between us. I don't remember what we talked about that night, but I do know that the discomfort was diminished. The wine just eased through me in that Greek restaurant, all the way through to my bones, illuminating some calm and gentler piece of my soul. Drinking with my father always made me feel like that. It wasn't so much that he got any less godlike when we drank. It was that I'd feel more God-worthy, less intimidated with a few drinks in me, more self-assured. I could plop down next to him on the sofa and talk. I could evoke those wide grins from him, punch him in the shoulder, create a version of the father-daughter rapport that felt more natural and ordinary. And what a relief that was, what release. The drink allowed me to respond to my father in a new way, to align myself with him without fear, to seal our pact. Over the years, I've come to think of memories as tiny living things, microorganisms that swim through the brain until they've found the right compartment in which to settle down and rest. If the compartment isn't available, if there's no proper label for the memory, it takes up residence somewhere else, gets lodged in a corner and gnaws at you periodically, cropping up at odd times or in dreams. All through my adolescence, I dreamed that the kitchen floor in our house was about to collapse, that the wood beneath the linoleum had rotted out, and at any moment the whole family would fall through. I dreamed about getting lost and not being able to find my way back home, and about picking up the telephone and not being able to punch in the right numbers. These are anxious images, false surfaces, false maps, an inability to connect, impending danger. At the time, I couldn't explain those feelings, the anxiety and the sense of disconnection. They certainly didn't stem from anything you could see by looking. On the outside, my parents' lives appeared eminently calm and controlled. Our household was quiet and gently rarefied, the kind of place where issues of The New Yorker and Harvard Magazine eased through the mail slot and landed in the front hall with a quiet thwack. And if you sat down to dinner with us at 7:30, you would have been struck by the sense of reserve, the white 12-inch candles flickering in the center of the table, the silence punctuated by the periodic clatter of a knife or fork against a plate. Common order, drinks at 7. And yet somewhere along the line, I became aware that the lack of storminess in our household spoke to its own set of problems, to a quality of subterfuge, as though difficult and dangerous things lay beneath the surface, too difficult and dangerous to speak of or even acknowledge. There were those strained moments at the cocktail hour before my father drank those first martinis. There was that sense of tension. There were headaches. My mother had a lot of headaches when I was a teenager. She'd say, "I have a headache," and then she'd shut herself up in her bedroom to take a rest before dinner, and sometimes she'd stay in there for several hours. I had a sense that the pain she felt was more than merely physical, but it was such a veiled feeling that I never pursued it, never asked her about it. The thing is, hints of distress are like air. You can't see them, can't hold them in your hands and subject them to proper examination. When I sat down to cocktails, my parents were a picture of staid sophistication, the bowl of peanuts, the dish of lemon twists. There was nothing identifiably wrong in there, nothing but a lingering suspicion of anxiety and sadness, something so subtle it seemed to exist only in the farthest reaches of the room, under the gray rug on the floor or whispering behind the curtains. The quiet control of our household complicates matters for me, and still does. There's so little to point to. My father singled me out in this weird way, and I became an alcoholic. Somehow that doesn't have quite the same ring to it as Abby's story. I come from generations of alcoholics, and I, too, became an alcoholic. A lot of AA meetings begin with what's called a qualification, which means someone stands or sits in front of the room and tells their story to the rest of the group. What happened when they drank, how they changed after they stopped. It's not uncommon to hear very dramatic qualifications, stories that start with the words, "There was a lot of abuse in my household," and go on to catalog the full range of modern American trauma, sexual abuse, physical abuse, psychological abuse. I sometimes feel a little out of place by comparison, a little guilty that my own narrative is so spare, and I often wish I had a story that would lay it all out in clearer, more vivid detail. Here's the setup. Here's precisely what happened. But there's rarely a single defining event, and even people from the most chaotic alcoholic background struggle with that knowledge. I can say that alcohol traveled in my family, but it did so with characteristic subtlety, in the quiet, winding manner of a hidden stream, and only from one direction, my father's side. My mother's family didn't drink at all to speak of, at least not alcoholically. I never saw my mother have more than 2 drinks, almost always a very watered-down scotch, and I never saw any member of her family drunk. For good or ill, I seem to have inherited more blood from my father's side. I looked like him, same high forehead, same hands and feet, same constitution. I also drank like him and took to liquor in much the same way. Not long ago, I found a journal he'd kept when he was 19, during a summer he'd spent on a ranch in the Southwest. Every third page had a drinking story. Drinking in small-town bars, drinking with dinner, repeated references to demon alcohol. I don't know if my father's parents drank, or how much, or in what ways. If drinking wreaked havoc on his side of the family, it did so privately, and the details were never shared with outsiders. There were clues, though, scattered bits of evidence that alcohol caused problems, but they seemed safely tucked away in the past. Years before I was born, my father had been arrested for drunk driving, twice, I gather. Back then, before he met my mother, he'd also been married to an alcoholic, a woman named Shelby. We used to hear about Shelby in ugly bits and pieces when I was growing up. She'd call on the phone drunk and yelling, making unreasonable demands, and an unspoken mythology grew up around her. She was a drunk, a sick woman, bad news, and the polar opposite of my mother, who was beautiful and graceful and controlled. We never talked about alcoholism, though, and we spoke about Shelby only in code. She called. She's having a fit about money or about one of their three kids. We all believed, I think, that my father had left chaos and illness behind when he left Shelby, exchanging those qualities for my mother's goodness. And we all did our best to ignore our feelings about Wiki, the truest legacy of that marriage and the one piece that followed him, inescapably, into his union with my mother and into my own early childhood. Wiki was my father's third child from his marriage to Shelby. He was blind from birth, emotionally disturbed, and severely retarded, although no one used that word, retarded. I didn't see him much when I was a kid, but he was always there in the background, an issue that wouldn't go away, a source of strain, and the only obvious one, between my parents. Wiki lived with them from 1956 to 1958, the first 2 years of their marriage. As the story I grew up with went, they'd been in Italy on their honeymoon, and Shelby, also in Italy at the time, had approached my father and said, essentially, "Here, he's yours. I can't deal with him anymore. You take him." My father couldn't say no, so they brought him home with them to live. Wiki was 10 years old then, a blind, angry, uncontrollable kid who resented my mother and let her know it. He had tantrums, got into things, broke favorite possessions. My mother described those years as a nightmare. My father kept promising they'd get extra help, find the right person to come in and tend to him, find the right program or psychiatrist or group home to help him. The truth was, he couldn't admit how far beyond help Wiki really was. My mother couldn't quite believe this. My father had wooed her with an intensity that seemed indissoluble at first, and Wiki's presence was the first real sign that his devotion to her might be more complex, more qualified than she'd felt it to be before. He was the first tangible sign of trouble from my father's past, of baggage brought and left, like the abandoned child, at her feet. A few months with Wiki turned into 6 months, then a year. My parents renovated their house. My mother got pregnant with Andrew, my older brother. Wiki was still there. When Andrew was an infant, my mother would find Wiki creeping blindly into his room, and it terrified her. Later, when Andrew was about 18 months old, Wiki turned a wheelbarrow over on him in the front yard and trapped him underneath. My mother was pregnant with my sister and me at the time. Wiki left shortly after that, went to a series of residential programs and schools for the blind, and continued, essentially, not to improve. He came back only occasionally from then on, weekends here and there, Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving. I found him upsetting and physically repulsive, and I used to cringe when I heard he was coming to stay. And yet Wiki offered an answer of sorts. When he came to visit, the tightness in the household seemed to creep up a notch. My mother's expression would grow more tense. My father would become more absent, more stressed and sad. Wiki explained that quiet sense of strain in our house better than anything else, and I learned to see him as the central problem, a cancer in my parents' marriage. The ill will he generated during his visit seemed entirely specific to him. My mother's headaches, my father's preoccupied sadness, the weight of silence the rest of us felt at the table. It was Wiki, wasn't it? It was Wiki. When I was 29, Wiki died suddenly of a grand mal seizure. He was 42. A few months after his funeral, my half-sister Penny, Wiki's oldest sister, sent me a letter about what it was like to grow up with him, breaking the silence about the role alcohol had played. "Nobody ever talked about it," she wrote, "but it's completely obvious to me that he suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome." Fetal alcohol syndrome? A life ruined by alcohol just like that? The news was jarring, one of those facts that seems to come out of nowhere, but also makes sense. I was drinking a glass of wine in my apartment when I opened Penny's letter. On some level, I could see by then that I was drinking too much, and I remember thinking that I wouldn't be able to have children if I kept it up. If I ever got pregnant, I thought the baby would turn out like Wiki. The thought startled me, but only for a minute. The main feeling about his death was relief. My father died 4 years later, on a Monday in April. I was 32 and unprepared. The morning before he died, a hospice nurse named Carla came to the house to examine him and said he'd probably live for another few days, possibly even a week. He'd fallen into a coma 3 days earlier. I'd already been drinking daily for the previous 5 years, maybe more, but when my father's brain tumor was diagnosed, all bets were off. His illness opened a well of fear in my chest that felt bottomless, and I drank to fill it, to escape it, to numb it. For the 2 nights prior to Carla's visit, I'd slept in the twin bed set up next to my father's hospital bed in my parents' bedroom. The idea was to give my mother some relief. I was terrified that he might die alone, and I think I was sufficiently conscious of reality at that time, of the fact that he really was about to die, that I managed not to drink too much on those 2 nights. I could be lying about that. I don't remember what I was drinking or how much. But I do remember standing by his bedside each evening before I went to sleep and putting my hand on his hand. "I love you, Dad," I'd whisper. "We're all here. Everything will be okay." These were not the kinds of things we said in my family. "I love you. We're all here." But I forced myself to say them. When Carla came, when she told us the vigil would go on for several more days, I decided I'd leave the house and spend the night with Michael, my boyfriend, take a little break. He and I would have dinner at the house with my mother and Becca and her husband Andy, and then we'd leave, drive the mile or so across Cambridge to his apartment. I drank cognac that night. I bought the bottle over the weekend, a bottle of Ragnon, and I'd stashed it in my bag. And every half hour or so, I'd go upstairs to my bedroom on the pretense of wanting to go smoke a cigarette. And I'd take the bottle out of the bag, and I'd smoke, and I'd slug the cognac, huge gulps of it. I went through more than half the bottle that evening, plus wine with dinner, plus a few beers before dinner, and I don't even remember getting to Michael's house. I passed out within minutes, and I was so far gone, so deep in the fog, that he had to shake me awake at 1:30 in the morning when the phone rang, when Andy called to tell us that something had changed, something was different about my father's breathing, and we'd better get over there now. Maybe we would have gotten there faster if I hadn't been drinking, if I'd been more alert, better able to throw on my clothes and jump in the car. I can't say. But my father died before we got to the house. Andy met us at the door. He looked at me and said, "About 2 minutes ago." I was still drunk. Around the time that Wiki died, I started taking those little quizzes about drug and alcohol abuse that you sometimes find in women's magazines or pamphlets at the doctor's office. And I started answering a lot of the questions positively. "Do you find yourself having a drink or two before you go to a party where you know alcohol will be served, just to get yourself in the mood?" "Yes." "Do you find yourself gulping drinks?" Check. "Do you drink more when you're under stress?" "Sure." But some of the questions seemed a little obvious, even kind of stupid. "Do you drink alone?" "Well, of course I drink alone. I live alone. What kind of a question is that?" The real questions, the questions I would have asked myself if I'd been willing to look more closely, might have been more pointed. Are you driven by a feeling of hunger and need? When someone sets a bottle of wine on the dinner table, do you find yourself glancing at it subversively, possessively, the way you might look at a lover you long for but don't quite trust? When someone pours you a glass from that bottle, do you take careful note of the level of liquid in the glass and measure it secretly against the level of liquid in the other glasses and hold your breath for just a second until you're assured you have enough? Do you establish an edgy feeling of relationship with that glass, that wine bottle? Do you worry over it, care about it, covet it, want all of it for yourself? Can you bear the thought that you won't have enough? Enough. That's a foreign word to an alcoholic, absolutely unknown. A woman I know named Liz calls alcoholism the disease of more, a reference to the greediness so many of us tend to feel around liquor, the grabbiness, the sense of impending deprivation, the certainty that we'll never have enough. More is always better to an alcoholic. More is necessary. Why have 2 drinks if you can have 3? 3 if you can have 4? Why stop? Why and how? Toward the end of my drinking, I'd go to a party and promise Michael I wouldn't drink too much. He'd plead, "Just take it easy, okay? Watch yourself." And I'd swear, "I won't. I don't want to get too drunk." I'd mean that, of course, and I'd start out by measuring myself. One glass of wine the first half hour, one glass the second, and so on. But then something would snap. Some uncontrollable process would kick in, and all of a sudden it would be 2 or 3 hours later, and I'd be on my 6th or 10th or God knows what glass of wine, and I'd be plastered. I couldn't account for it, couldn't explain it, couldn't even rationalize it, although I struggled mightily to. I seemed to get drunk, blind drunk, against my will. The knowledge that some people can have enough while you never can is the single most compelling piece of evidence for a drinker to suggest that alcoholism is, in fact, a disease, that it has powerful physiological roots, that the alcoholic's body simply responds differently to liquor than a non-alcoholic's. Once I started to drink, I simply did not know how or when to stop. The feeling of need kicked in, so pervasively that stopping didn't feel like an option. About 6 months after my father died, Michael's parents came up to visit from Connecticut, and the four of us went out to dinner. His parents don't drink much, so he ordered only one bottle of wine for the whole table, a single bottle, which poured out to about a glass and a half each. I remember feeling awkward in front of Michael's parents, whom I didn't know very well, and depressed about not having a father of my own, and generally apprehensive. Times like that, that fearful, grabby hunger would creep up on me in a way that felt so strong I couldn't concentrate on anything else. We sat and picked at an appetizer, and Michael and his parents chatted idly about this and that, and I felt so distracted by the hunger, so uncomfortable in my own skin, I thought I might explode. The feeling was unambiguous. Nothing is going to do the trick here except wine. Nothing is going to make me feel less awkward or less depressed or less anxious except more wine. Nothing. "Could you excuse me for a minute?" I stood up and said something about looking for the ladies' room. I made my way out of the dining area, and then, instead of turning down the hall to go to the bathroom, I took a left and slid onto a seat at the bar. I ordered a glass of red wine and drank it in about 2 minutes, chugged it, really. Later that night, back at Michael's and sitting around his living room chatting with his parents, I found an excuse to go out to my car. I think I told Michael's mom I had a book out there I wanted to lend her. In fact, I had a bottle of scotch stashed under the front seat, and when I got to the car, I grabbed it, and I just sat there in the dark and drank a good 2 or 3 inches of it straight out of the bottle. I just remember the hunger, the need. Most alcoholics I know experience that hunger long before they pick up the first drink, that yearning for something, something outside the self that will provide relief and solace and well-being. You hear echoes of it all the time in AA meetings. That sense that there's a well of emptiness inside, and that the trick in sobriety is to find new ways to fill it, spiritual ways instead of physical ones. Searching, searching. The need cuts across all backgrounds, all socioeconomic lines, all ages and sexes and races. Part of this, of course, is culturally determined, or at least culturally reinforced. The search for a fix, for a ready solution to what ails, has become a uniquely American undertaking, as prevalent as the nearest diet workshop or plastic surgeon. In some ways, alcoholism is the perfect expression of that particular brand of searching, an extreme example of the way so many of us are taught to confront deep yearnings. Fill it up. Fill up the emptiness. Just take it away, now. I still don't know today if that hunger originated within my family or if it was something I was simply born with, but I always seem to have had it. Some external fixation with things, some need for self-soothing. As soon as I could sit up in my mother's lap, I started rocking myself back and forth, and I did this for years. When I was a child, my parents had to put a mattress against the wall in my bedroom because I'd sit against the wall during nap time and rock back and forth and bang my head into it. Later, I developed a more elaborate system. I'd get on my knees and elbows and curl up in a ball on the bed, face down like a turtle in its shell, and rock away for hours sometimes. I can see the rocking now as a first addiction of sorts. It calmed me, took me out of myself, gave me a sense of relief. I don't know what I needed relief from at that time, age 5, age 6, but I clearly needed relief from something, and the rocking worked. I'd sometimes go up to my room and rock for an hour or so before dinner, closing the door, turning on the radio, climbing onto the bed and rocking myself into some kind of alpha state. I almost always rocked that way before I went to sleep, rocking away for 30 minutes or an hour. I was deeply embarrassed that I did this, ashamed of it really, but I needed it. I needed it and it worked. The truth, I did this until I was 16. The rocking was just like drinking. But drinking was so much more effective, its comfort so much more reliable. Over time, over many, many drinks, that knowledge is incorporated, the lessons folded into the soul. Liquor eases. Liquor soothes and protects. A psychic balm. Did that set me on the road to alcoholism? I wouldn't have thought so as a teenager or a young adult, not from looking around me. Reading books, watching TV and movies, I made connections between drinking and camaraderie, drinking and machismo, drinking and sophistication. Simple images. The boys slugging down beer at the end of a work day. Nick and Nora clinking cocktail glasses in the Thin Man movies. I knew people got into trouble with liquor, but those cases seemed isolated and largely foreign, the result of circumstances that had little to do with me. Betty Ford, well, she was a president's wife. Imagine the stress of that. Celebrity addicts, Marilyn Monroe, Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli, Elizabeth Taylor, you name it, they crashed in direct response to the pressures of fame, their extraordinary careers and lifestyles. Who wouldn't? As for the rest of us, drinking looked entirely normal, and for the most part entirely social. It was something that brought you out of yourself and into the world, into bars and parties and elegant restaurants. The idea that alcohol might play a more complicated internal role, that it might function on a much deeper emotional plane, was lost on me. Once, though, I saw a hint, a tiny clue, written in a single sentence in the back pages of a book called Getting Better, by New York Times reporter Nan Robertson, a review copy of which arrived on my desk at work in 1988. The bulk of the book is about Alcoholics Anonymous, how it started, how it works, how it fits into current thinking about alcoholism. I flipped through it in my cubicle, thinking, ho-hum, AA, who cares? But then I started reading the final chapter, called Nan's Story, and I came across a description of the way she used to drink. She said she was a boring drunk. She never got weepy or maudlin, never threw up on people at parties, never made embarrassing scenes. Drunk at a party, she might wander off to the guest bedroom and pass out for an hour or so, a refreshing hour's nap, as she saw it, and then return, wondering why the rest of the guests were looking at her strangely. She wrote, "I withdrew in other, more subtle ways. My husband used to say, when Nan gets bombed, she goes off into some little room in her mind and pulls down the shade." That line stuck with me for many years. Without stating so explicitly, that image had to do with the places alcohol can take you. It had to do with transportation, with the very real, and to alcoholics enormously seductive, phenomenon of taking psychic flight, ingesting a simple substance and leaving yourself behind. I read it over and over and over. Many of us drink in order to take that flight, in order to pour ourselves literally into new personalities. Uncap the bottle, pop the cork, slide into someone else's skin. A liquid makeover from the inside out. Drinking will transform us. And it does, at least for a little while. It melts down the pieces of us that hurt or feel distress. It makes room for some other self to emerge. A version that's new and improved and decidedly less conflicted. Without the drink, you were version A. With the drink, version B. And you can't get from A to B without the right equipment. A man I know named Alex describes himself as a gregarious introvert. He can't stand being alone, can't stand sitting quietly with his own thoughts, and yet he is terribly shy. So when he discovered drink in high school, he thought, ah, the elixir. He could talk to anyone after a beer or two or three. The deep thing inside that made him grimace and squirm, the part that felt like a dry, steady itch of discomfort, just washed away. His whole being seemed to fall into place. When Alex describes this in an AA meeting, the whole room nods. Right, absolutely. It's the equation we all lived by, every single alcoholic I know. Discomfort plus drink equals no discomfort. The mathematics of self-transformation. For a long time, when it's working, the drink feels like a path to a kind of self-enlightenment, something that turns us into the person we wish to be, or the person we think we really are. In some ways, the dynamic is this simple. Alcohol makes everything better until it makes everything worse. And when drinking makes things better, it does so with such easy perfection, lifting you, shifting you, just like that, into another self. I can trace that feeling back to early adolescence, age 14, age 15. I was that age the first time I took a sip from one of my father's martinis and felt the gin on my tongue, simultaneously cold and warming. I was that age, 14, the first time I drank beer at a bar, the first time I heard the waitress setting down a pitcher on a hard linoleum table, then felt that glass in my hand, solid and cool and reassuring as a kind of currency. I suppose that marked the start of what would become a cumulative process, a Pavlovian phenomenon of persistent reinforcement. This feels good, the way this glass of white wine flows from bottle to glass to throat to brain, the way it tingles and warms and lightens. This feels good, the way a group of us gather around a table, elbow to elbow, united in the camaraderie of drink and laughter and reward. This is such a common sensation to a drinker. My friend Meg says she felt like the real her was trapped somewhere inside, locked up in a cage beneath her ribs. When she drank, that version was freed. For years, she says, it felt like the road to truth. She smiles and adds, in vodka veritas. About a year after I quit drinking, I heard some tinkly cocktail music on the radio in my car. It sounded like the kind of music you'd hear in a fancy piano bar, and I flashed for an instant onto a period in my 20s, when I used to spend a lot of time drinking at the bar at the Ritz Hotel in Boston with my friend Sam. Sam was great to drink with because he had a huge tolerance for alcohol but didn't drink alcoholically. He could match you drink for drink, and he'd never say no if you wanted to stick around for one more, or two or three more. But he'd never get too drunk. You could always count on Sam to be sane enough at the end of the night to figure out the tip or get you home. He was also great to drink with because he was always late. That meant when we'd meet in the bar after work, I'd get to sit there for at least a glass or two before he arrived. I'd sip the wine, and I'd feel the tension ease and drain away, and I'd begin to feel elegant and calm and enveloped. A pretty young woman waiting at the table, picking cashews out of the nut dish, waiting for her date. When we drank together, my sense of time would shift. Sam would get there, and there'd be a slightly self-conscious 20 minutes or half hour until we eased our way into the drinks and conversation. And the next thing you knew, it would be 2 or 3 hours later, and we'd be in the middle of some deep talk about family or therapy or work. And I'd feel right there, genuinely united, as though we'd really spoken to and heard one another. I loved those moments, the sense that the world had boiled down to such simple elements. Me and Sam and the two glasses on the table.